Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona, Rebecca, there was a recent surprise on the visa bulletin for October 2020, wasn't there?
Yes, Mark, there was indeed a surprise with the October 2020 visa bulletin. We want to discuss that along with another, quite a few other issues, as well as issues relating to EB5, EB2, and EB3 employment categories, which have jumped significantly, especially for India-born applicants. So today, what I thought would we would have a couple of guests on the show who are very familiar with the area.
Familiar is putting it mildly, Mona. We have over 100 years of law practice on today's episode. So my introduction will probably be all that you hear from me for a while. First, I'd like to welcome to the show Edward Bashara. Ed is a managing partner of Bashara PA and has been exclusively practicing U.S. immigration law in Orlando, Florida since 1983. Wow, that's almost four decades. He represents corporate and individual clients from countries around the world and has ranked among the top 25 EB5 immigration attorneys by EB5 Investors Magazine and a recipient of IIUSA's 2019 Award for Economic Achievement Innovation Award. Edward, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark, for the introduction. And I'd like to thank Mona for the invitation. And I really welcome the following discussion with Ginny and Rebecca. Very much looking forward to it, but thank you again.
You're welcome. We're looking forward to it as well. Also joining us on today's episode is a series regular, Jenhee Wild. Jenhee is the founding partner of WA Law Group LLC, which is an immigration law firm based in Maryland. Jenhee has also been practicing law for over three decades and has consistently been named one of the top 10 or 25 immigration lawyers. Her work is so detailed that she's only received three RFEs on source of funds issues in 12 years of doing EB5 cases. So we're really looking forward to her input. Jenhee, welcome back to EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you, Mark, for such a glowing introduction, as always. It's good to be invited back. Thank you, Mona. I'm really looking forward to our discussion today. There's a lot to discuss.
All right. So let's jump straight into this. Jenhee, you know, when we talk about the visa bulletin, a lot of people don't really understand what we mean. And there is a chart A and there's a chart B. So far, there's not a chart C. What we do want to know, though, is what is the difference between a chart A and a chart B?
Well, normally, chart B is for those people overseas who's doing consular processing to jumpstart their process before their priority date actually becomes current. Because the consular processing and National Visa Center takes about 6 months, you can start the filing process and get all your civil documents in order and all of that stuff and wait for the consulate to set an interview for you when your priority date becomes current.
But your priority date is not chart B.
No, priority date, actual priority date where you can actually get a visa, immigrant visa or a green card is based on chart A, the final date.
Rebecca, what is the significance of the chart A and B's dates?
What's significant for those who are in the U.S. is that chart B, the dates for filing, has actually opened where applicants within the U.S. can file an I-45, which is the adjustment of status application. So with that, you can also file your employment authorization document, or as many know as your EAD, so you can lawfully work in the U.S. And you can also file for your advanced parole, which is your travel document. So you're going to get a combination card for you to be able to work and travel as your I-45, your adjustment of application, is pending. So this is great news for those in the EB-2 and EB-3 categories because they have been relying so much on their H-1s, having to renew it every year as they're waiting for their priority dates to become current. Now they can go ahead and actually get their application in, their adjustment of status, and also be able to obtain a work authorization and travel authorization.
Ginny, I know Rebecca just mentioned that you mentioned that the Chart B had opened up considerably for India. What about other countries? Do you see a jump in other countries too?
Not dramatically. China did move forward a year from 2017 on EB-3. It's not that significant of a jump from previous month. India was the most notable.
Right. Well, Rebecca, you wrote a scathing article, which was out this month in this area, whereby you're really stating that USCIS have done this and made a lot of fees out of it.
Yes. For those, it's feel free to please read the blog piece, but to just touch on it, I did write because as of October 2nd, USCIS was going to increase the fees. Under normal circumstances, for I-45 applications to adjust your status, you normally don't pay an additional fee for your employment authorization or your travel document. Isn't that correct, Jinhee?
Yes, it used to be just bundled.
Yes.
All three forms filed with one filing fee. For the new fee proposal, they have decided to separate every single one. And actually, the amount of fee that they were proposing to charge for employment authorization was over $500 nothing.
Yeah, for both applications, actually. Such a jump in your dates for filing, your Chart B, where you can file for your adjustment of status, with such a jump from 2010 to 2015. Imagine how many thousands of applications that are going to file under the EB-3 category or EB-2 category. That's thousands of applications filing with the additional fee.
Yeah. I mean, when you combine all three together, it would have been at least $1,000 or more for each applicant.
Yeah.
So when you're thinking about, they were going to make several hundred million dollars all at once.
Well, with any luck, some of this money might trickle back into getting more adjudicators and moving along a little faster.
Yeah.
That's the hope, right, Ed?
Yes, definitely.
More adjudicators isn't faster times.
Yeah, more adjudicator was not leading to faster time.
No, but they didn't put the actual fee. So a judge did rule and they stayed. So the fees did not increase on October 2nd.
Well, that's still under consideration. I mean, that's in front of a lower court judge, so that's being appealed.
Exactly.
Which is kind of confusing because while that's an appeal, you don't know what to charge clients.
Yeah, so that's one issue.
But Ed, let me ask you, Chart B, I understand it's not the green card, right?
No, it's not the green card, but it acts as a huge benefit for those applicants that want to be able to have the freedom to work anywhere by obtaining the employment authorization card, be able to travel. And even though the priority date is not current based upon Chart A, now they're able to be able to pursue maybe different types of employment and travel immediately.
There's quite a lot of people who would have been considering EB-5 in that section who now will think we don't need EB-5 anymore because we have all of these documents. But Rebecca, what? It's the age-out children issue, right?
Yeah, so there's several issues. Before we even get into age-out issues, there's, a lot of, as you, Edward, you were saying that they're able to get the employment authorization, you're able to move on. But under the EB-2 and EB-3 categories, you still have to be careful. You can go ahead and port to new employers, but there's a time restriction. You have to make sure you follow the similar employment that you were in for this in order for you to still obtain the green card under the EB-2 and EB-3 categories. So even though it's good news, there's still some caveat that you still have to consider. And in addition to that, a lot of clients think that, with Chart A, Chart B is current now, it means that my child's age has stopped. And that's incorrect, that your child's age is still going with Chart B. So even though you can file an I-45 or you can file at the consulate the documents, it doesn't mean to say that your child will be able to stay in your application with you if they're close to 21.
Well, you know, let's explain that a little bit, because I think the age out issue is so important for so many people. Perhaps, Jinhee, you would like to explain what the CSPA age is all about.
Well, CSPA, or Child Status Protection Act, says that age out children for the purpose of accompanying their parents can benefit from any application, immigrant petition pending. They can deduct that pending time from their actual age. So if your immigrant petition I-140 or EB-5 in I-526 is pending for 2 years, even though your child may have reached the age 21 and could be aged out, for the purpose of following your parents, you can actually deduct 2 years of that pending time, which is very helpful. But once the immigrant petition has approved, then time starts moving forward again. So for many clients from India or China, that the priority date has not been moving for years and years and years, many of these children are out of luck while they were waiting for the priority date to become current.
Is that the same for EB-2, EB-3, and EB-5, or is EB-5
different?
Everything.
Yes. Everything. Mm-hmm. Every immigrant petition goes through this.
But Ed, though, if you're like 20 and you file your 526, then the child's age has frozen.
Right, at that moment in time. But as Jinhee and Rebecca New are saying, once the petition is approved, because of retrogression, these longer time delays, the child may be aged out. And I'd like to have that explained a little bit further because I think a lot of people may not understand that fact, that it's not just the petition being approved when the child may be over 21, but it's the reality of this long delay before the priority date becomes current.
Yes, you're 100% correct in that, Ed. It doesn't affect most countries, right? Because the priority date is current. As soon as you get approved, you can go ahead and file for your green card automatically. And so the CSPA is invoked, and that your child is going to be the same age as they were once you file the application. But like we said, with India, China having backlogs or retrogress, their age starts to kick in once that petition, whether it's the I-140 or the I-526, once that is approved, your age begins to run again. And if your priority date is not current under Chart A, the final action date, that means you have a potential, if your child is 20, you have to wait 2 or 3 years down the line for your priority date to become current under Chart A, that your child has the potential of aging out.
I'm just wondering, when the priority date established, the filing of the 526, and then the petition is approved and the child is already 21, what period of time does the child have to do something to be protected?
Well, you can deduct the, let's say, 2 years. It took 2 years to have the immigrant petition approved. You can deduct the 2 years from the current age of the child. But if the priority date doesn't move for 2 years, you just lost that 2 year that you gained, and the child ages out anyway.
It's such a complicated area, and it's really a case by case, it's country by country basis. It's based on category that I honestly think is such an unfair rule regulation that is in immigration. Once your child has filed and is under the age of 21, no matter how long you have to wait for a visa to become available, that child should always be included in an application. That's my feeling.
I totally agree. Yeah, no, I agree. And I think you guys agree too, that this is really unfair. And it only targets two countries really at this point, India and China.
Yeah, that's true.
Just as a side note, we've had, and I think we all have, had children that are students and that are going to school. Mm-hmm. You know, they're 20, 21, 22, and they've been gifted, let's say, the EB-5 funds by their parents, and they're in the waiting line under a 526, or they could even be under an EB-2, EB-3. And when they started the immigrant process, they were single. But now they've met someone at school who are citizens of a country that's not mainland China or India. So they can use the citizenship of their new spouse to avoid these retrogression and time delays, correct?
Yes, that's cross-chargeability. Yes. Which really helps. But I think that's very rare to find, especially with students. You know, a lot of students now, you know, it's going to be years probably before you meet someone.
Yeah. And Ed, we're not encouraging child brides here. So,
yeah.
But here's the point. This is to you, Jinhee and Rebecca. We're hearing a lot about people downgrading applications right now from EB3 to EB2, because you said that EB3 jumped to 2015. And so EB3 for our listeners is for unskilled workers. EB2 is for skilled workers. And a lot of...
No. Actually, there's two categories in EB3.
Great.
There's an EB3 and then there's an EB3 other. Other is the unskilled worker, and EB3 is bachelor's degree or higher.
Ah, I see. Mm-hmm. I learn something every day. So what's the difference between the two EB3s then?
Well, EB3 other is sometimes called EW. It is truly for unskilled worker. It doesn't require education. It doesn't require experience. It's for janitors, meat processor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. EB3 is bachelor's degree or higher, and many of the H-1B holders are bachelor's degree or higher. EB2, on the other hand, is master's degree or higher.
Ah.
Again, many H-1B holders have that. So you have two categories under which that H-1B holders can be sponsored, or under EB-2, there is also a NIW, National Interest Waiver, that many Indian doctors use to get a I-140 approved.
So what does it mean to downgrade an application then, Jinhee, and what are the advantages?
Well, I mean, if you have a master's degree, it's obvious that you have also had bachelor's degree.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had filed an EB-2 under a master's degree or a doctorate, it's likely that EB-3 can be also done. You can downgrade to a EB-3 process. We have had clients downgrade from master's degree required to bachelor's degree required I-140.
Hmm. So here's the point. At the beginning of October, when the visa bulletin came out, because we work with a lot of different developers, many of the developers who were concentrating a lot on the H-1B market panicked, because they thought, oh, a lot of the H-1B people now will not need to go file for an EB-5. Should an applicant still continue with the EB-5 process, Rebecca and Ed?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why?
Unless your priority date is close to the current date that's in the visa bulletin. And a reminder that it has to be current under the chart A, which is still years behind. It only moved 2 or 3 months from September's visa bulletin to October visa bulletin. You're still going to wait a very, very long time for your green card under the EB2 or EB3 category. Remember, it jumped.
What's a very long time, guys?
We've heard all sorts. You know, it could be 30, 40, 50 years we've been hearing. Someone said 100 years plus. It's a very long time. You're still waiting to receive a green card under that category. What helped is that, yes, you can file now under the EB3 category if it's current for your EAD, your travel permit and work authorization. But at the same time, it doesn't give you the permanent green card.
I'm sure some people would have issues with it not giving you a permanent green card, right?
And I have issues too with, and Jinhee, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, but I have issues with people downgrading from EB2 to EB3 because I mean, we've had a lot of clients ask about this. And my issue is that you have to consider, one, do you have age out children? You know, downgrading an application means filing a whole new application, and it's going to take months again for you to get an approval off of that application. So you're not going to get your EAD technically until, you know, normally when you file an I-45 application with your EAD and travel permit, you can get it within 90 days. If you're downgrading to an EB3, it could be months before you go ahead and get that. So that's one of the issues I have. And the other issue is if everyone is downgrading from EB2 to EB3, then don't you think EB3 is going to end up retrogressing?
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned that because people think that, oh, I can downgrade. Well, you currently have an EB2 I-140 approval. You do not have an EB3 I-140 approval, which means you have to actually file an I-140.
And pay the fees?
Mm-hmm. And pay the fee. And then get that. It is not an automatic downgrade.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you are qualified, as I said, and everyone who has a master's degree or higher also has bachelor's degree, so your eligibility is there, but you have to still take the step. And it's not an easy step. And unlike EB2 NIW, the National Interest Waiver, where you can self-petition, EB3 is based on a sponsorship of an employer. So you have to find the employer mm-hmm. in your area and all of that. So it's not an easy just shift. Oh, I can just file this.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on every single person, what kind of I-140 they are holding in their hand. And the only people that I am advising that they're safe to go ahead and file is people with an NIW. Because it is self-petitioned, they're not tied to any employer, their movement is much freer. But with anyone who has EB2 or EB3 based on an employment sponsorship, you're still tied to that employer.
Well, that's good news for the EB5 bed, right?
Right, because basically, you know, even if Chart B has a shorter period where you can eventually apply for the adjustment and get the work authorization permission to travel under the EB3 category. Yes, this 2015, according to October 2020, that means that if you file a petition today, you would still have to wait another 5 years before you could apply for that adjustment if these numbers and dates remain the same. So with EB5, if you file today, well, then usually the processing of a 526 at the 2-year mark, we should get an answer, or we file a federal court action to get an answer. And then over the next few months, you should be able to get your conditional green card. So if people have the funds, then it's definitely still a very fast process compared to the other categories.
Yeah, I agree. All right, guys, moving on. I want to talk a little bit about consulates and adjusting at the consulate, adjusting in the United States, because this is another issue at the moment with COVID, because so many consulates are still closed with COVID. So Jinhee and Ed, are the consulates open?
I'm hearing that Mexico City is open and London is open, but I know all the India consulates are still closed, and China, Guangzhou, is closed. So I am not sure. There is no one website that shows all the consulate that's open. I wish the State Department mm-hmm. would do that, but they don't. And you have to literally contact each consulate that applies to you to find out if they're open, when they may be open.
So if you're from an Indian place, for example, can you just pick and choose which consulate you want to go to?
No. I think it's based on where you live in India. You either go to New Delhi or you go Mumbai.
But also remember, we've got the dilemma that based upon executive orders and proclamations, mm-hmm. immigration still is suspended as a whole, except EB5.
Until end of this year, yeah.
Yeah, well, right. Well, hopefully. Hopefully till the end of this month.
Yeah. And so basically those interviews that were postponed because of the pandemic, hopefully those individuals will be rescheduled when the consulates do open. Mm-hmm. So you've got the two dilemmas, you know, the consulates closed because of the pandemic and the suspension of immigration, except if you are related to a US citizen or permanent resident, or you're going through an EB-5 process. So again, for these EB employment-based categories, I'm confident and positive that there will be a reopening, right? But right now it's going to be wait and see and patience.
Yeah, I think the reopening, we're not looking until probably next spring. And then even with some of these consulates, even though some of these are open, for instance, like you said, Jinhee, London, it's case-by-case basis, and they're doing it based on emergency situations. Most of the routine visa services has been suspended. So again, like you said, it's consulate. You have to look at the consulate you're looking into, and then it's a case-by-case as well.
You know, one thing I want to mention is the fallacy of closing the consulate except for, you know, legal permanent residence relations, USC citizen relations. The virus doesn't care if you are related to a USC or EB-5 applicant. So I just want to put it out there, because it's that has been the fallacy of everything that's dealing with this pandemic from this administration.
But what about if someone has applied for a non-immigrant visa, like an E2 visa? We're doing a ton of these right now. Are they able to go anywhere and get their visas adjudicated? And if not, guys, can they come into the United States on a B1, B2 and have their visa E2 visas adjudicated here?
Well, remember, you know, Toronto has opened to a certain extent, so we're seeing Canadian E2s, but also the people that already have E2s, of course, can leave and re-enter with new status. But I think one has to be very careful that if someone comes in as a visitor, their intent should only be part of the permissible activity of coming in as a visitor, which is to visit. If they're coming in to work, well, then I don't think that's right. So, but subsequent to their entry, if they decide to change status after, let's say, 90 days from a visitor status to an E2 status, of course, you know, that would be authorized.
What do you mean by intent, Ed?
The intent is that if you're coming in as a visitor, if you said to the inspector at the airport, I intend to visit, and the inspector says, well, you know, do you intend to come and work in the US? No. Do you intend to be employed or go to school? No. Okay, then please come in. If the question is to another visitor, do you intend to work in the US? No, but I want to set up a corporation and I'm going to work for that corporation. They would not be allowed in.
Jinhee, if people do come in and adjust, what is the timeline that they have to be in before the intent issue that Ed has just been talking about disappears?
Minimum is about 90 days. Because 3 months is about time that, let's say, for example, in the example that Ed just mentioned, that you came in to visit and you decided that after looking around and visiting here or there, that you actually stumble across a wonderful business opportunity you saw. And you decide that, oh, I'm going to buy this business and I want to do this. That's one thing. But if you are coming in visiting, but with intent to change to something else, there is a presumption that you didn't disclose that information and that is a fraudulent intent and misrepresentation made to the immigration border officer. And that becomes a huge problem. Because fraudulent, intentional fraud and misrepresentation is a permanent bar to immigration. Mm. I have to stress, intentional. So what your intent was when you made that statement becomes very important.
Mm, thank you. So this is to all three of you. We get this question all the time, and I'm sure all of you do. people ask, what is better? Is it better to adjust my EB-5 status, so EB-5-2, a green card status in the United States, or is it better to do it at the consulate? What are the advantages and disadvantages?
You know, if before the pandemic, I was advising clients to do the consular processing for, especially for EB-5 clients, because it was faster. Mm-hmm. Going through the National Visa Center, civil documents, and then, you know, interview was about 6 months, whereas under the Trump administration, adjustment of status was taking longer and longer. It is now well over a year with that process, if not longer.
Mm-hmm. My view is this. Look, I've been practicing now for 37 years. All those years.
Less on the years, emphasis on the years, Ed, please.
You know, we've been going to immigration, INS back in those days.
I remember.
Right.
My age too.
Yeah, INS, I'm not sure. Basically, we've been saying to them, there's a disconnect between the business reality and the immigration reality. So basically, the immigration reality means that back in those days, they had policies and regulations that really didn't match the real world. And that's become worse today. So when one is making a decision between, you know, do I go and be interviewed by a USCIS officer? Because with EB-2 and EB-3, not only are you applying for adjustment, but when the priority date becomes really current, then you're going to be scheduled for a personal interview. And what we're finding lately, and when I say lately, 2019, 2020, the interpretation, adjudication, the inconsistencies, the meanness of the adjudication process by USCIS officers, not applying the law correctly, the test, that not only should they only be looking at the person as an individual and the family members, but they seem to be re-adjudicating the underlying petitions that have already been decided favorably in favor of the applicants. So with the possibility of re-adjudication, the meanness, the inconsistencies, et cetera, it seems like maybe the better process is going through the U.S. consulates. They seem to be acting a little bit more professional, less questions, and relying on the fact that there was a previous adjudication and approval of the underlying petition.
Rebecca? Actually, I'm sorry, but I have to disagree with that. That used to be the case. But under this administration, the consulates overseas have been taking their right to re-review the underlying petition.
Mm-hmm. I agree
yes,
with you.
Yeah. I agree. Mm-hmm.
And they have been much more mean and yes. inconsistent overseas as well, especially with EB-3 category. It seemed like there has to be a memo somewhere. They won't disclose it under FOIA, but there has to be something going on where they say, we're going to suspect everything under EB-3 as illegitimate job offer, and we're going to deny it. Because there have been too many.
I would say that I'm the complete opposite. I have a complete opposite view. I find, and we have many, many cases going through USCIS and the US consulate, we have never had really any issues with the US consulate. Even in 2020, that's from our standpoint, we've never had any issues.
So, Ed, you deal a lot with Latin America.
We deal with globally. Mm-hmm. We deal with it globally. So, you know, whether it's Australia, New Zealand, whether it's England, whether it's South America, whether it's Europe, India, we've had no real issues with the U.S. consulate. It's all to do with our clients sitting before a USCIS adjudicator and not applying the test if they re-adjudicate. Also, the concern that we have is that if there's fraud, well, then there's nothing that we can control about that if it comes out that the clients were fraudulent. Thank goodness it doesn't happen to our clients. But there are fraud investigators that are taking the place of normal USCIS adjudicators already knowing that there may be inconsistencies, bringing up these inconsistencies and denying the case because of the inconsistencies, which may not be a result of us, the attorneys, representing the clients at this point, but it may be something that goes back 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years.
Yeah.
So there's more unreasonable review at the USCIS level.
So if you're talking about at the I-45 and consular processing stage, I see more issues at the consulates.
Yeah,
I will knock on wood, all my I-45 adjustment of status applications have gone through without, you know, unless they're RFing because you forgot a document or a medical. I've not seen anything, any issues in regards to like them coming back and adjudicating your
I-45. Rebecca, what I'm saying is that we ultimately, our clients get approval. But I'm saying that the review process at the USCIS level is a lot worse than consular.
I see the opposite.
But we're still getting results, but I'm saying that this is our experience. And as a lot of the lawyers that I talk to, whether it's in Florida or elsewhere, are having the same experience.
Isn't whether you file at the consulate or whether you do it as an adjustment, isn't this something that you have to organize or decide at the time of filing the petition? Isn't it a pain in the neck to change halfway?
Well, actually, that is really true. When you're filing the immigrant petition, there is a section saying, I am already in U.S. and I will adjust, or I will go through the consulate of my home country. I have found that even though you've checked the consulate box, if you happen to be in the United States on a valid status, when that petition gets approved, you can file an adjustment of status right away without waiting for anything. But if you do the flip side and you say you're going to adjust, and because of retrogression, because how long it took, 5 to 6 now is taking, 36 months at the minimum? Your circumstances change. And you're not in the United States when that gets approved. But because you checked that box of adjustment of status, you have to now ask the USCIS to take another action. Please send my approved petition to the National Visa Center by filing Form 824, which used to take 2-3 months, is now taking 8 months or more.
Yes, so, I've seen a year.
More than a year,
So to jump in then, Rebecca, you would suggest always filing the adjustment of status or not always filing it?
Yeah, no, I agree 100% with Jinhee that you need to speak. And like you said earlier, you need to speak with your attorneys first. You need to figure out, am I going to be in the U.S. for X amount of periods? And you have to also see, when is your non-immigrant status going to expire? Do you have it for the next 3 to 5 years? Is it going to expire next year? I always advise my clients, if you're not 100% sure, then you always go with consular processing. Yeah. It's easier because if you are in the U.S., you can easily adjust. If not, then you have to do a whole new application. It's also important to note, you know, I have issues sometimes with the consulates just to change a consulate because someone's moved from one country to the other. So it's very important to keep your immigration attorney updated and inform them what's going on.
Ed, I'm going to give you the final say here.
No, I like that approach. You know, it's easier to say that if you're going to go through consulate processing, you indicate that on the petition being filed, it's easier than that if one changes their mind to adjust in the U.S. or file the application in the U.S., it's easier to do that because you're right. You know, the 824 is taking a long time to get that notice to the NBC.
Well, I've been very quiet on this episode. From what I'm taking away from this, it really depends on a number of things, of your status, your country of origin, perhaps your history, and ultimately your strategy that you formulate with your immigration attorney. And so with that having been said, I want to thank you, Jinhee Wild and Edward Bashar, for coming on today's show.
Thank you so much for having me again. It's always a pleasure.
And thank you, Mark. Thank you, Mona and Rebecca and Jinhee, for being involved. And thank you, Mona, for the invitation. It's well appreciated.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshahlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.